Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Oh my gosh, everybody, welcome back to The Worst Year Ever. This is part two of the first two episodes.
Part two of episode one.
Oh my gosh. You get two on the first day.
Isn't that exciting? Because we didn't budget our time well, but it's a gift for you guys.
Yeah, we just have too much to say to each other.
Yeah.
We do, and speaking of gifts, oh wait, no, it's not time for products and services.
Not quite.
I am just a hack. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I accept your apology on behalf of everyone listening right now.
We don't traditionally open with ads.
We actually do on ours.
I have an addictive personality, and I have gotten addicted to ad pivots, and it's a real problem. If I don't do it twice a day, I just get the shakes. Sometimes I'll pull my car over in the street and just shout at a passing police officer, "Try Hims!"
Is Hims like a diaper for dudes? Adult diaper?
No, it gets your dick hard.
Oh, it's a dick hard pill. Cool,
it's
cool.
A dick pill. It's a dick hard pill. Yeah.
Is it spelled like the word him or the other
word
him?
But with an S.
Hims.
No, not like what religious people do. Although selling hims has become my religion.
I mean, I'm sure that gets some people hard.
Is this podcast sponsored by Hims?
Maybe one day.
We can only
hope. I'm terrible at this
job. Fingers crossed.
Penis
is crossed, everybody.
Yeah, Cody, do you want to talk about the Washington Post?
Yeah. Saying penis is crossed and then talking about the New York Times. All right. So I'm actually going to talk about the New York Times and the Washington Post kind of together because I think they have kind of similar problems and kind of similar positives.
Mm-hmm.
They are two of America's papers of record, a phrase that tends to mean that they're, you know, very rigorous. They show attention to detail and have accountability in their editorial process. And they have like a truly like a national view and attempt to be the best possible record of what happened in the nation, not just in a region for the day. And we could debate how much they do that or not. But as I think we all can guess or remember, the New York Times and the Washington Post are both generally pro-war, another theme that I think we all sort of get with a lot of these mainstream news organizations.
Now, Cody, unless it's war against Nazi Germany in the late 1930s, in which case they think we should see how this Hitler guy plays out.
Let's like hear him out, let him do what he's going to do, and we'll just keep to ourselves.
Yeah, be neutral.
Yeah, it's just another, balanced viewpoint.
Put America not second.
Yeah, exactly. whatever the synonym for not second is. Also, specifically, pro the war in Iraq. Is interesting. I think that like the war stance that draws claims of bias is the anti-war stance. No one really accuses anybody of bias if they're pro-war.
Right.
Interesting thing about our culture. Both New York Times and Washington Post have also been heavily criticized for their reporting on the Obama administration's drone strike program and their general lack of reporting on civilian casualties for that program, which civilian casualties are, I guess one would describe it as a problem with drone strikes.
Yeah, I certainly would.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. And to quote a study from Jay Bachman from the School of International Service at American University, the willingness of the New York Times and Washington Post to state positively that only legitimate targets were killed in the immediate aftermath of drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan is especially problematic because exactly who was killed in drone strikes is difficult to immediately confirm. The study found
it's not always.
Not always. Not always
difficult.
Not always difficult.
Yeah, the site that I write for, Bellingcat, did a fun investigation last year where they traced back one of the missiles that we sent Saudi Arabia that was used to blow up a school bus with a couple of dozen small children on it.
Yeah.
Fun, legitimate targets.
Seems a theme, like a school bus, hospitals, weddings, things of that nature.
It's a war, you guys.
Yeah. Hey, okay. It's a very old, long war. The study found that civilian deaths there were reported in stories 9% of the cases where civilian deaths were actually proven to have occurred. So they just did not report on them.
Wow.
Neither New York Times nor the Washington Post have corrected their errors in failing to accurately report on the effects of drone strikes. And the editorial departments of both papers have said that it is either not up to them or not in the paper's policy to run corrections on such stories. So,
cool.
Papers of Journalism. Record, yeah, love that response.
A, a, Another fun fact, the New York Times' nickname is the Gray Lady because the entire staff are huge fans of the erotic novel Shades of Gray.
No.
Yeah. Very, very cool.
I wasn't going to include that because it seemed a little blue, you know, a little rough around the edges for our very clean podcast, but that is true.
Sounds pretty basic to me.
Well, you know, not for the paper of record, so...
I actually hate describing things as basic because it just describes something that's popular and that people enjoy.
People like it. Yeah. We'll move on from the drone strikes, but I think it is hard to understate the detrimental effect of a misinformed public getting sort of like normalized to civilian deaths from drone strikes. Like, we've talked about normalization a lot and normalization of violence, but like, if you have this president who's not really criticized for a lot, especially stuff like this, and you're not even reporting on these civilian deaths, and you're sort of creating this idea that drone strikes are actually like very safe and effective when they're totally not, and they kill people pretty indiscriminately with a lot of collateral damage. It's bad, I would say.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a bit with me and PodSave.
Good, okay, yeah. My theory is that it's bad.
Yeah, I concur.
Okay.
My theory is that pod is going to, in fact, save America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, well, you put a pin in that.
All right, well, I thought they were, but I guess not. They do good reporting, too. Like, the Washington Post has a great, like, investigative team. People like Dave Fahrenthold, they do a lot of
Fahrenthold's
good
reporting. Incredible political reporting.
I tend to like stuff, lot of things that the Washington Post specifically puts out.
And that's, I want to make that clear. Like, they do good reporting. And, I mean, the New York Times was the first to publish the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah.
They got sued for it. Like, they do good things. That was a long time ago, but...
Actual reporters at the New York Times tend to be very... I've worked with a number of them. Tend to be very, 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 very good at their jobs. Like, the actual investigative journalists and stuff who are doing the work, like, most of what people get pissed off at is, like, the op-ed section and stuff. Like, there is a lot of really good original reporting done by the Times, and I would never want to pretend like there isn't.
Yes, exactly. I want to make that clear. We're going to get to the op-ed stuff.
Yeah.
But again, like, sort of going with the theme, I think... that is generally true, is it's just they're very pro-war and not questioning of the military, things like that. The Washington Post, by their own admission, ran 140 editorials and articles supporting Bush's wars.
Wow.
They at one point apologized for its practice of burying articles, but the problem wasn't that they buried stories. It was just that the anti-war stories were vastly outnumbered by the pro-war stories. So they just did not do the reporting. One study posited that there was just a sort of general attitude among the editors that boiled down to the idea that, like, the war was inevitable, so why publish these contrary voices? Mm-hmm. Interesting that you want balance, but not when it comes to maybe saying that, like, nuh-uh to war, you know?
I mean, is it possible that war is a good thing, though?
For their paper.
I haven't considered it. I guess I should read their many, many articles about how it is.
Why don't you start with that?
Yeah.
Do some research, Cody.
Okay, I will read their 140 articles about how Bush's wars are good. So they have that problem. Robert, you alluded to, what I think we really should talk about are the Washington Post and New York Times columnists and fact checkers. On Some More News, we actually recently did an episode written by Creature Features' own Katie Golden about Brett Stevens specifically. He's a New York Times columnist, and how he's basically used his columns for his own petty bullshit combined with climate denial.
Right.
And that's what the New York Times op-ed seems to be, a place for out-of-touch elites to sort of air their petty personal grievances, mostly involving how kids on college campuses are totalitarian. In one column by Barry Weiss, as her only evidence of this totalitarianism, she linked to a fake Twitter account. Recently, columnist Brett Stevens, after being called a bedbug by a Jewish professor in a tweet that got 5 likes, Brett wrote an entire column that likened him to a Nazi. And as evidence, shared a link to Google Books with the search field reading Jews as bedbugs, which led to him finding a quote about bedbugs that completely undermined his point because the quote was about literal bedbugs.
It's unbelievable.
So it cool. seems like maybe there's like a complete lack of oversight and editorial rigor, which a paper of record should probably have.
I would say
It also seems like if they fired Brett Stevens for his salary, they could afford to pay a couple of dozen really talented journalists to investigate like 6 to 10 really complicated stories a year each, and provide like more than weekly content that was incredibly useful and groundbreaking. But because they don't, we get to know that Brett Stevens Googled Jews as bedbugs.
and did not read the quote that he found. He didn't even read it.
No, of course not.
Unbelievable.
No, why would he? He found it in a book, therefore what that professor did to him was the same as the Holocaust.
Exactly.
QE fucking D.
You just got blown up, random Jewish professor who I think is a Nazi now. It's just a real problem.
Yeah, it is.
And so this actually kind of started due to new leadership from James Bennett. He was put in charge of the editorial page in 2016. Interesting year for this to start, 2016. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that year and how good it was.
I've heard
for
of
everybody.
It, yeah.
So James hired a bunch of Brett bugs to, as he claims, we're looking to challenge our own and our readers' assumptions. Never mind that the paper only seems to be challenging any assumptions from the right, and many of the readers' assumptions about climate change are true, so don't need to be challenged by Brett fucking Stevens. But in general, the spectrum of challenge is pretty narrow, too. Glenn Greenwald points out, it spans the small gap from establishment centrist Democrats to establishment centrist Republicans. Again, just sort of all these viewpoints that are approved and none that are like war bad, maybe more taxes, I don't know, things like that. This all reminds me of the liberal consensus. This is something I think about a lot, and I think it helps to understand some of what we're seeing here and on the internet and culturally in general. In the 70s, there was something developing called the liberal consensus. One could make an argument that this is because reality sort of leans liberal, but basically there were these nonpartisan organizations like the New York Times and the Brookings Institute, and conservatives saw them as incredibly biased. Like, the Brookings Institute would do studies, and they would study issues and do research and gather facts and sort of come to conclusions and propose policy. Mm-hmm. It was a nonpartisan organization meant to do that. And a lot of their policies were liberal-leaning, right? But it was the result of a nonpartisan effort to research and understand an issue. So in response to this, people were very mad that Nixon was sort of buying into the liberal consensus. So we started to see things pop up like the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation, these sort of conservative think tanks that were responding to what they saw as bias.
I see, yeah.
So they're saying, you're biased, therefore we're going to be biased.
Right.
Right? So you have like all these institutions were basically admitting their own bias and their goal being to find facts and information that they can use to prove a conservative policy is worth pursuing. Mm-hmm. We see this a lot, shades of it at least, in people like Ben Shapiro. Prager University is great at this. You'll notice that a lot of their speakers are actually from the American Enterprise Institute. So you start with a conclusion, you find facts that can support it, as opposed to finding facts, doing research, and then analyzing it to arrive at a conclusion. So there's always been this sort of push against the liberal consensus and liberal media in the 60s. The first instance of it was used by George Wallace. And it was used to basically discredit the civil rights movement, saying the media only supported the civil rights movement because of their liberal bias.
Oh, so it's been going on for a while.
It's been going on for a while. And it's this sort of general idea that has been building and building over the years.
And we're becoming more and more polarized.
Right.
By this.
It's this push against the liberal consensus, liberal media, and saying that, like, well, now we're going to do it, even though they weren't doing it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like Fox News, they go full far right conspiracy nut job as a response to what they perceive as bias, and then we get to sort of where we are today. I think we're still grappling with it. There's more to say about, like, the Powell memo that sort of pushed more think tanks, more lobbying in favor of big business, regardless of the facts. So I think there's always this seeming call for balance when balance isn't warranted.
Right.
Which, again, is sort of what we've been talking about, where you have 50 articles about climate change and then 50 articles denying climate change. But that's not balance. That's the illusion of balance in the face of what reality actually is.
Right, because denying climate change is just lying.
Right.
You're not being balanced at all. You're putting something out there that isn't true.
Yeah, and so you have these, I think a lot of these institutions, like the New York Times, who are being accused of this bias, and they're like, well, you don't have any of these voices and any of these voices, and so they're trying to create a balance that doesn't actually exist. They're getting all of these columnists to write about how we need more nukes and how climate change isn't real, and how all the college campuses are just a bunch of lib snowflakes, while I'm going to accuse some critic of being Hitler. And that's why we are sort of here now, it seems.
Yeah,
to me.
More criticizing their articles about war, less criticizing liberal.
Yeah,
liberal
it's just, and bias. And like again, like I'm not going to say there's no liberal bias and things like
of
that.
Of course,
but this is sort of where we're getting at.
Well, and I think also like a big chunk of the liberal bias that like doesn't get written down as bias is actually their bias towards wanting to be that fucking kind of Cronkite voice that like that that leads them to giving weight to sides that ought not be given weight just because they want to be seen as being fair because that's more yeah. important to them than accurately reporting on the truth.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Because getting attacked is like they just can't handle it. And I think part of that's to do with a lot of the fact that a lot of our most prominent voices in mainstream journalism are rich kids who got the job because they were able to take an unpaid internship, who went to J school and learned all the things you learn at J school, which often doesn't interact with like what actually makes a good journalist,
right.
And whose family is tied into like the media industry somehow. Like it's a bunch of people who, when they get actually like attacked, can't push back because mm-hmm. they don't have any kind of like they're gormless at a fundamental level. And that is not good.
Yeah, right. As soon as they're accused of that bias, they're like, "Oh, I guess we are. We have to fix that.
I gotta overcorrect." Yeah,
yeah. It's a lot of overcorrection. And in general, just saying what your narrative is. I know the head of New York Times recently said like, "Oh, we focused on Russia for a couple of years, and now we're not going to do that because right. that didn't work out. So now we're going to focus on race." And this idea of like choosing your narrative for like the next year and right. a half. Well, that's not.
That's not journalism.
That's not journalism. You research, you react, you analyze right. and stuff. You don't just say like, this is our narrative now. So I don't care for that. But speaking of people airing personal grievances and papers of record and wanting balance, except when it comes to the left, the Washington Post today, Thursday, September 12th, 2019, ran an op-ed called "I Like Elizabeth Warren. Too bad she's a hypocrite." And I'm going to I'm going to briefly read this thing, and I want you to stop me when you think that I've made my point. Warren attacked former Vice President Joe Biden. Off to a good start, Liz. Personally, this is me saying good.
Yeah, good job, Liz.
For holding a kickoff fundraiser in Philadelphia in April, which she criticized as a swanky private fundraiser for wealthy donors, in an email to supporters the next day. Well, I helped organize that affair. And I thought her attack was extremely hypocritical because nearly 20 of us who attended the Biden fundraiser had also given her $2,000 or more in 2018 at closed-door fundraisers in swanky locations. You didn't stop me, but if you didn't catch that, well, I helped organize that affair. This is a
right.
person who just, like, they organized the thing and they're upset, so they're writing an article about it.
This is ridiculous.
And, like, we will, I'm sure, in other episodes talk about Elizabeth Warren and her donors,
Ooh.
But, like, come on, Washington Post.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy, right? Like, it's just this person who's totally involved, and at least yeah. they mentioned it. They don't always do that, but they seemingly have a huge bias against anything on the left of the establishment Democratic Party, especially Bernard Sanders. In 2016, they ran 16 negative articles about him in 16 hours.
That's wild.
Yeah, recently.
Well, but I bet they ran 16 positive articles about him in 16 hours,
too. To be balanced.
I bet they did
that.
To be balanced. To be balanced, yeah. I bet that proved their balance. Recently, Glenn Kessler gave Bernie Sanders 3 Pinocchios about a claim that 500,000 people go bankrupt every year because they can't pay outrageous right. medical bills. So he fact-checked this, gave him 3 Pinocchios. The claim was proven to be true within Glenn's article.
What?
His source for the fact-check said that it was true.
That's so bizarre. I mean, it's
okay.
just...
But it's kind of like, guys, if you multiply... -1 × -1 × -1, you get +3? I don't understand math, but I think that means that 3 Pinocchios equals a truth.
Well, he yes. they
Pinocchios equals one truth.
He lost a couple Pinocchios just because he felt like it, you know, took a couple
yeah.
off.
Something about Bernie mm-hmm. just knocks those Pinocchios
He's
out.
He's like, but
know?
Also it's Bernie, so take two off.
Yeah, maybe mm-hmm. it has something to do with the Washington Post being owned by the richest man on the planet, Jeff Bezos. Somebody
no,
Bernard Sanders thinks should have significantly less money, mm. criticizes mm. Amazon all the time. I don't know, maybe.
Mm.
Cody, that's like suggesting that I skew my coverage in favor of dick pills because they support my podcast.
What else do they
and,
support? Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah, they support healthy erectile balance.
They support blood flow.
Mm-hmm. That's unbiased.
There are claims that Bezos is pretty hands off with the Washington Post. I don't know. Maybe he is. That doesn't mean that there is not this sort of push Again, we see it. We see the New York Times, too. We see it in established media in general. One quick note, also today, September 12th, 2019, the Washington Post published their last issue of their Express publication. Because, you know, money, digital media, sort of, we're all going under. The cover says, "Hope you enjoy your stinking phones." As if the Washington Post isn't owned by the richest man on the planet.
Right.
But that's the gist. I just think we should be wary of things like that, of specifically their editorial columns. You'll see a lot of disclaimers. One thing I've noticed a lot of, there are a lot of articles that are like, oh, the Democrats are going too far left for me to vote for them. But then you're like, oh, it's written by like Dick Cheney or Ari Fleischer or something like that. It's like, these people.
Were you going to vote for them anyway?
Never. It's this sort of like taking a moderate or a centrist or a Republican right. and saying like, oh, the Dems are going nuts. Which I think is a bit of a dishonest framing.
I agree with you completely. We got to take a quick break for things.
You know what? Okay.
You appear to be done speaking.
Yeah.
Breaks.
I thought you said I love crepes, but we're not.
I do love crepes.
I love crepes too, but that's not. I assume that's not what we're selling.
I'm selling that right now. Buy crepes.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
We have returned from break now.
Oh.
Ow, ow. Those were great ads.
I loved them. I bought them all again.
Oh, you're going to run out of money.
I keep buying them.
But that money is coming back to you in a way. Yeah. So, all right. We got a lot to get through. I'm going to be pretty quick on what I'm here to talk about now, which is Pod Save America. Mm. You guys are familiar.
That's the goal of this podcast, right? Are we trying to save or destroy America? I have forgotten.
Destroy America so that we can build it back up again in the way that we prefer.
if we have time, I mean, I guess like we'll pencil that in after destroying it. If we wind up,
all podcasts are an evolution, so we'll see what happens if we want to rebuild it back up.
Yeah, because part of me is thinking that after we destroy America, that's probably the time for us to launch our podcast about Frasier, where we break down every episode in an exhaustive 45-minute detail.
Oh, I love that idea.
Yeah, so maybe we'll destroy America, we'll talk about Frasier for 3 years, and then we'll rebuild it.
Okay, that's a good plan. Okay. You guys on board?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to push for saving America. I don't want to rock the boat here, but I think I'm going to convince you both by the end of the year that we should save it.
Robert, Cody's out.
Okay, Cody's out. All right. Well, let's see. Can we
marketplace of ideas, huh?
Can we get the ghost of the dog that played Eddie on Frasier to be our third?
Yeah.
All right. We'll get a Ouija board.
He'd be a perfect fit. All right. We're going to talk about Pod Save America specifically.
Sophie's right here. What if it's Sophie?
What? No. Oh, Sophie's right here.
No, I was hoping you would hire Anderson.
Wait, are you saying Sophie is the ghost of the dog from Frasier?
No, I was just offended that you would hire a dog that isn't my own. Mine.
A ghost dog at that.
Sophie, it's the ghost of a dog.
I know, but your sibling is in this room and you're not going to hire her?
Listen, the ghost of that dog has a lot of star power.
Yeah, it's relevant. Sophie, it's relevant to the show. There's gonna be a lot of stories.
Have you seen my dog's butt? Come on,
very cute.
I've never read employment law or talked to an employment lawyer, but I do think we're legally bound to hire ghosts before living dogs.
Mm-hmm. But we'll check into that and we'll circle back. Okay.
Cool.
We won't.
Ghost Act of 2004.
All right. Pod Save America. Pod Save Bros. Because they're bros, y'all, right? They're bros.
Well, you know that that common phrase, God save America?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, cool. Sorry.
Yep.
Pod save.
See, that's another, in the first episode, we talked about Jake Tapper writing Himbo and then calling it a day. They were brainstorming on names.
Unbelievable.
And somebody said, what about Pod Save America? And that was the day.
That's what
that
they landed.
That was the work that got done.
I know. Okay. So Pod Save America is comprised of Jon Favreau. Not that Jon Favreau. John Lovett. Not that John Lovett. Tommy Vitor and Dan Pfeiffer. During the
Don Pfeiffer.
Did you say Dog Pfeiffer?
Yes.
Mad Dog Pfeiffer, as we like to call him. During the 2016 election, they hosted Keeping It 1600. Also not a great name. But then after Trump won, they rebranded as, we guessed it, Pod Save America. And started their own podcast network called Crooked Media. Yes, that is a quippy Hillary reference. Yeah. Very cool. I think it's important to distinguish that they do have some interesting shows on that network. Pod Save the People is hosted by civil rights activist DeRay McKesson, and that's very well done. It doesn't have the same kind of bro-y perspective of the Pod Save guys. With Friends Like These, dives into understanding people on either side of the aisle. And I've been known to listen to the all-female panel show Hysteria, which How Stuff Works host Dana Schwartz is a frequent guest on. So they do have some good programs to offer. But we're here to talk about Pod Save America specifically. There's too many of them to go into all of their backgrounds, but suffice to say that they all met while working for the Obama administration. Pfeiffer was the communications director. Viter was the assistant press secretary and national security spokesperson. Favreau and Lovett were both speech writers. One little thing that I found interesting was that I guess at one point Lovett secretly officiated the first gay wedding at the White House, but because it was during a time when Obama's views on same-sex marriage were still ambiguous, he straight up did not have permission. Like, they told him not to. And in several interviews, Lovett has been quoted as saying, "We were very nervous. They were nervous because they were getting married, and I was nervous because I snuck into my boss's house to perform a wedding against his wishes in his backyard."
That's actually pretty cool.
I know, it is pretty cool.
I actually did the same thing in Jack O'Brien's backyard, but the people who got married were unaware of the wedding, too. So it was really...
Wow.
Doubling down.
So you were really nervous.
It was same but different. Yeah.
How are they going to react when I tell them that they're married now?
One tidbit that I found less fun, slightly, is that apparently at one point, Jon Favreau posted a picture on Facebook of him posing with a cardboard cutout of Hillary Clinton and grabbing her boob.
Cool.
As scandals go, that's not a big one, but it is pretty bro-y.
It's pretty bro-y.
And again, that's the thesis that I keep coming back to about... I mean, this is just a general vibe. That's my opinion listening to the show. It's why I don't listen to it anymore. Right. So I don't know if they've evolved a bit since then, but that's kind of a consensus that people have. But people love to tune in and hear their perspective. I mean, they've got a really unique one. They've been inside the party for a long time. They've seen what a functioning White House looks like. But they get a lot of criticism based on the very valid perception that because of this access that they have, you know, they have been in the Democratic Party for a long time. They have access, that they have some blind spots criticizing the establishment and the people in the establishment, or that they don't want to lose that access, you know, by pushing too hard, by pushing too many buttons. For example, when you listen to Pod Save America, you're going to get no real criticisms of Obama. They were a part of the Obama administration, even during, like... We're in a period right now where we're seeing these mass child detentions. And that's a policy that did start under the Obama administration. Yes, Trump has made it worse and changed it and like ratcheted this whole thing up. But there's a real conversation that needs to happen about the Democratic Party, what Obama's administration has, what role they played in all of this. Yeah. But whenever something like that comes up, they dodge the issue. Same thing with talking about drone strikes.
Yeah, yeah.
The drone program that Obama, you know, that started there, it continues to this day, and nobody talks about
it. And it's worse now because the president is worse.
And it's just, and that's, it's very frustrating. And that's something that's frustrating to me in general when we're talking, going through this whole primary process. I think it's fair to criticize Obama. That doesn't make him a completely bad person. It doesn't mean that everything he did was bad, but you have to be able to have some self-reflection. And that is the main thing for me that's missing from Pod Save America. The whole thing. Like just this week, Cody shared this with me, but Jon Favreau tweeted a glowing endorsement of former UN Ambassador Samantha Power's new book, The Education of an Idealist, which is, I guess, a memoir that takes a look at U.S. foreign policy from the inside. It apparently talks a lot about Bashar al-Assad and Russia, but fails to acknowledge anything about Obama's drone program or how the U.S. armed al-Qaeda in Syria, you know, or about Yemen, you know, the stuff that's going on in Yemen with America's support. So it's, again, just whitewashing, you know, highlighting what they want and like ignoring the actual issues that people have.
A situation like Yemen, like she was involved with that and just being like, hey, check out this book. I don't know. It's It is that
it shouldn't be a source you go to for news. It's a source where, like, they obviously, as you pointed out, they have some unique perspective that's not not valuable. Like, there's certainly value in hearing from people who've worked inside a functioning White House.
Absolutely.
But they're not journalists. They're a propaganda arm of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's why I originally did listen to their show and liked it, because most of what they talked about was, like, related to, like, their experience in the White House and, like, how the White House functions. And it was interesting to get that perspective. But then the election happened and they kept sort of being wrong and, like, doubling down and, like, not sort of reflecting on that. And it became way less interesting.
Well, but didn't they keep it 1600? No, they didn't. They didn't. That might mean the pod won't save America.
It might.
I don't know if it won't. The Pod Save America team has also supported the United States of Care. I'm going to let Cody talk a bit about this because he knows more about it. But basically, the United States of Care is an initiative that aims to put healthcare over politics and to change the conversation. I mean, healthcare is politics, but okay. Mm. Also, the council working on this initiative is comprised of a ton of healthcare executives. People have spent their lives ripping people off in exchange for their lives, and they claim to be a safe space to discuss common sense solutions. And their mission statement says, United States of Care is a new movement to ensure that every single American has access to quality, affordable health care, regardless of health status, social need, or income. And that's a pretty conservative talking point. Access is very different than having.
Oh, yeah.
And there's been a lot of pushback online from that. And they've waffled. You know, they've come out as saying they're for Medicare for all. But then, you know, they start, you know, support this, or they're tweeting, I'm a Medicare for all advocate. This is from Jon Favreau, by the way. I'm a Medicare for all advocate. I also want to make sure that there's a path to get there, which involves building a movement and persuading people who don't currently agree. So it's a different approach. It's more of a centrist, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, it's super centrist. I find issue with a lot of this framing a lot from, like, Favreau, where he's like, you know, it involves building a movement and persuading people.
Right.
Well, John, I don't know if you're familiar, but in 2015 and 2016, there was a movement. You dismissed it, and now that it's a popular idea, you're adopting it, but still sort of couching it in this language of access. Like,
yeah,
it's just like a movement happens, and a candidate says for 2 years, healthcare is a human right. And he said it so many times that people now think that, because it's true. And now they're sort of like piggybacking on that movement, but also like to the detriment of the movement by like allying with like what former Senator Bill Frist is involved in this organization. A lot of private insurance companies are involved, and you still have like Lovett doing these sort of rants about how we got to keep the private health insurance if you like it and things like that, which stops the actual momentum of the movement and persuading people that this is a better path.
Right.
If you're saying like, we got to do this, we got to do this and this incremental change, and like, we got to protect this, then you're not actually persuading people.
Yeah.
Of the thing that you actually want, which is Medicare for all.
Right.
So saying you're for Medicare for all, but doing all this other stuff tells me that you're not really.
Right. Another thing that people find frustrating about Pod Save America, again, that they have access to all these candidates, but they rarely ask them hard-hitting questions. And when they do, or they just let the person, you know, get off the hook with a pretty slippery answer, I'm sure that has to do, again, with the access question of not wanting to burn bridges, wanting to be a place that people want to go. But you're squandering an opportunity.
And they're not journalists.
And they're not journalists.
Like, you know, experience with that. Like,
it takes, like, speaking as someone who's done a lot of interviews, like, there's a thing you have to get over when you're kind of new to it, where, like, we're trained to be kind of non-confrontational, just in civilized society. And like, you have to be willing to say things to someone's face that will make them hate you.
Yeah.
And if you're not a journalist and not experienced doing that, you're just not going to do it in a conversation.
Right.
Like, you're just not.
And especially in that community. Especially. And that sort of like with their establishment friends and like having been there.
I mean, sure, in the interviews, but they also have big people come on. They've had the presidential candidates coming on, Love It or Leave It, John Lovett's own show, and do this like Queen for a Day type segment where they'll ask them a bunch of really intense questions like, as president, would you recognize a hot dog as a sandwich? And like, part of me is interested in seeing
groundbreaking.
I part of me is curious about seeing how these very serious people are in a less formal situation, but not really. What's more important to me is to like take that time to ask Amy Klobuchar something important.
Right,
you know?
They're there.
You're there.
Why are you like wasting this opportunity?
Why are you squandering this opportunity?
It's like having Donald Trump on your show and like testing his toupee and like trying to humanize him.
It is.
And ignoring the fact that like he's calling a huge chunk of the country vermin.
Yeah. Jimmy Fallon might as well be a pod safe.
Yeah,
bro.
Yeah.
And one little thing I wanted to say, and this is according to Cody.
Oh no, what did I say?
Love It is the one that suggested to Elizabeth Warren that she take the DNA test that proved that she is 100% that bitch who doesn't have very much Native American blood at all. I was wanted to do a Lizzo joke. I'm sorry.
I did hear that.
It was a really bad call, and it was the kind of really bad call you'd make if, like, one of the things that makes these guys so bad at actually analyzing a real presidential election is that their only experience getting a guy elected was, quote-unquote, helping to get the most charismatic politician of any of our lifetimes elected. Like, Barack Obama didn't need that much help.
No.
So I don't trust that these guys actually have good advice on how to get a president elected.
I don't either.
Because their previous experience is the most charismatic man alive in the country got elected and they were around.
Right. Yeah. Also, Lovett didn't join the administration until after he was elected.
He worked for Hillary. Didn't get her elected either.
Right. Mm.
Sure did not.
Neither time.
They all also worked for John Kerry. So maybe not all of them, but most of them did.
I might say they are the worst people to ask about how to get a president elected.
And they might be the worst people to try and save America. Okay. We're going to take a real quick break again, and then we're going to come back and hear what Robert has to say about stuff.
We're going to talk about Nate Silver, but first, enjoy these ads for silver that you put up your butt to cure diseases. We're selling butt silver, right, Sophie? That's one of our sponsons?
She's nodding yes.
Okay,
She's confirmed
it. She's not.
She's confirmed it.
Products!
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
We're back!
We're back.
Now, we have to get through this last bit quickly, so we're going to have fewer interjections, which is why this is a good time for me to talk about Nate Silver, a man who Cody Johnston personally finds deeply engaging and, dare I say, powerfully erotic. On to the story.
That was defamation.
If you were a politically engaged person who feared the rise of Donald Trump in 2016, there is a better than even chance you spent a lot of time refreshing the website for Nate Silver's poll aggregating thingamajig 538. Presumably, many folks will do the same thing throughout 2020, sighing in ease as Trump's chances fall and cringing as they rise throughout the campaign. Ooh. On the surface, 538 seems like a totally down-to-business, numbers-focused endeavor that can be relied upon for objective analysis of the polls. The reality, of course, is murkier. Nathaniel Reed Silver was born on January 13th, 1978. He fell in love with baseball from an early age. If you aren't a fan of the sport, this may come as a surprise to you, but baseball is essentially Dungeons and Dragons with an optional component where human beings get out in a field and do stuff. To many, many fans, baseball is about the numbers, calculating run averages and turning players into collections of statistics. In a 2006 Chicago Tribune profile, William Hagman wrote this about Silver. Quote, Silver caught the baseball bug when he was six, growing up in East Lansing, Michigan. It was 1984, the year the Detroit Tigers won the World Series. The Tigers became his team and baseball his sport. And if there's anything that goes hand in glove with baseball, it's numbers, another of Silver's childhood interests. It is always more interesting to apply it to batting averages than algebra class, Silver said. Now, as a high school student, Nate was an avid debater and a state-level champion. He was not a big fan of public speaking, but he loved delving into research and crafting arguments. His childhood in East Lansing, Michigan was pretty normal, outside of his love for baseball, which is objectively a red flag. He wrote for his high school newspaper and showed an interest in both journalism and economics. Nate went to the University of Chicago, where he thrived and eventually got a degree in economics. He spent some time working as a consultant for a gigantic accounting firm in the early aughts, but his true love remained baseball. He spent most of his free time crafting a system for predicting the performance of professional baseball players. He named it the Player Empirical Comparison and Optimization Test Algorithm, or PICOTA, a reference to the name of a relatively obscure infielder named Bill PICOTA. In that Tribune article, Major League... Yeah, he's a huge nerd. Huge nerd.
Also, and you said he wasn't a big fan of public speaking. That's why he loves Twitter. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In that Tribune article, Major League Baseball consultant Gary Huckaday described how Pecota worked. Quote, Nate isolated five components how a player provides value. Then Pecota looks through the history to find similar players who have had similar performance shapes at the same age. It takes a look at all those guys in the past who have been similar and takes a look at what their careers did after a certain point. Keep that in mind because it will be relevant to Nate's later work in politics. Now, Pecota was successful enough that Silver eventually sold it to a site called Baseball Prospectus. He got a job there as a managing editor and did that for a while. As George W. Bush's presidency wound down and the 2008 election campaign started winding up, Nate Silver found himself focusing more and more on national politics. He started an anonymous blog under the name Poblano and provided his analysis of the polls, which often differed from the conventional wisdom of the pundit class. Nate's hot takes were based in large part on applying the lessons he'd learned analyzing sports to politics. I'm going to quote from a New York Magazine profile now. Sports and politics offer several obvious parallels. Both involve a competition, essentially between two teams. Both involve reams of statistical data available for devotees to sort through, or more commonly, for intermediary experts to sort through, analyze, and then interpret for you. In baseball, these stats track player performance, how many hits a player gets, and when and against what kind of pitchers. While in politics, the data tracks voter preferences. Who do you like and why? What kind of choice are you going to make on election day? These stats, on their face, seem pretty straightforward. If a hitter hits 300, he's valuable. If Obama opens up a 6-point national lead, he's in good shape. So, in May of 2008, Nate had his first major win. Pollsters started predicting Hillary Clinton would win big in Indiana and only lose by 8 points in North Carolina. This was seen as evidence that her campaign was finally recovering from the temporary lead Obama had accrued over the past few months. Silver, blogging as Poblano, only got around 800 daily visitors to his site at the time. That changed when he published an in-depth breakdown of Clinton's polling numbers, which suggested she would lose by 16 points in North Carolina and only win by 2 in Indiana. The final numbers were a 1-point win for Clinton in Indiana and a 15-point loss in North Carolina. So Nate had been almost exactly right. Very close, and every major pundit had been wrong. Nate went on to correctly predict 49 out of 50 states in the 2008 election. Or at least, that's how things were reported. Time put him on their list of 100 most influential people for doing that. 2 years later, Nate's new website, 538, was bought by the New York Times, netting him a pile of money. Now, the reality of that award he got for predicting the outcomes of 49 out of 50 states was that Nate had not, in fact, predicted anything. His model had calculated what it saw as the most likely outcomes for all 50 states.
Right.
And in 49 of those cases, the end result had gelled with that calculation. Mm-hmm. There's a difference, though. Nate had not said Obama is going to win all these states. Instead, he'd said my analysis of these polls shows Obama ahead in all these states. And the media had sort of translated that into Nate Silver correctly predicts the results.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, this is not hair splitting. There's a very important difference between the two.
Yeah. This actually happens quite a lot with like him. And just even like with 2016, on the reverse side, everyone often says like, oh, everyone got it wrong. Trump won. Everyone got it wrong. No, they didn't get it wrong. If you say someone has a 20% chance of winning and they win,
right.
You're right.
He hit
the 20% chance. Like that's how this works.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. That's how numbers work.
Yeah.
So Nate builds this 538 blog, and as he did it, he was again sort of taking the ideas that had first earned him success in the realm of baseball and applying them to politics. There is a lot of logic to this system. Here's New York Magazine. Quote, in concocting 538, Silver decided the best way to read the polls was to put them all together, with the idea that averaging 10 polls would give you a better result than trying to pick out the best one. Again, he wasn't the first person to do this. Other sites like Real Clear Politics and Pollster offer the same service. But, as Silver told me, sometimes the answer is in looking at other alternatives that exist in the market and saying, they have the right idea, but they're not doing it the right way. So he came up with a system that predicts pollsters' future performance based on how good it's been in the past. In finding his average, Silver weighs each poll differently, ranking them according to his own statistic, PIE, pollster-induced error, based on a number of factors, including its track record and its methodology. One advantage of this system is that, during the primaries, the system actually got smarter, because each time a poll performed well in the primary, its ranking improved. So that's what Nate does. And, you know, for years, Nate Silver was considered to be something very close to a prophet by many, in particularly sort of like the liberal side of things. In the 2012 election, 538 was lauded for correctly predicting the results of all 50 states. It won a Webby Award. In 2013, it won another. And Nate sold the site to ESPN and became its editor-in-chief. Or I guess the New York Times sold the site to ESPN. Yeah. 538 relaunched as something more akin to a major news site in 2014, covering a wide variety of stories with the perspective of data journalism. And then came the 2016 election. It would be a stretch to say this election was Nate's undoing, but it was a blow to his reputation. Like everyone else, 538 predicted a Clinton win as most likely. However, that bird's eye view alone is not fair. Nate Silver actually took a huge amount of flack from the left from, you know, giving Donald Trump a 30% chance of victory. On November 5th, 2016, The Huffington Post's Ryan Grimm published a very dumb article titled, "Nate Silver is Unskewing Polls, All of Them in Trump's Direction." Now, that unskewing line is a reference to a bit of political history some of you may remember. Back in 2012, a moron grew convinced that all of the polls were biased against Mitt Romney. Using nonsense math, he unskewed them to predict a massive victory for Mitt. This did not happen. So while outlets like HuffPo gave Trump like a 1-2% chance of victory, 538 showed his campaign as having a serious fighting chance. And Nate Silver, to his credit, repeatedly outlined that Trump had a very viable route to an Electoral College victory. I'm going to quote from Ryan Grimm's article now. "The short version is that Silver is changing the results of polls to fit where he thinks the polls truly are, rather than simply entering the poll numbers into his model and crunching them."
That was a good voice.
Silver calls this unskewing, thank you, a trend line adjustment. He compares it to, a poll to previous polls conducted by the same polling firm, makes a series of assumptions, runs a regression analysis, and gets a new poll number. That's the number he sticks in his model, not the original number. He may end up being right, but he's just guessing. So this guy basically said that, like, Trump benefited unfairly from the skewing and, of course, right, ate his words hardcore when Trump won. And, like, you know, I think it's actually unfair that Silver took some took flack for, like, not giving Trump more of a chance of victory, because he really did repeatedly point out he could totally win.
Yeah.
If the things that happened.
Like, there's a chance he will win.
Yeah.
Silver gave him a solid chance of winning, and he won. And you got to give the dude credit for that.
Also, like, this, like, he may end up being right, but he's just guessing. Everyone's guessing.
Yes.
Everyone's guessing, homeboy. Yeah. None of you. Yeah. Now, I just gave Nate a lot of credit for his performance in the 2016 election, so it's also fair that I criticize him for the things that he was wrong about in that election.
Yes, please. I'm ready
for it. In August of 2015, 538 published this article under Nate Silver's byline: "Donald Trump is winning the polls and losing the nomination."
Yeah. Oh, buddy. Yeah.
Now that is just like guessing and like wishful thinking.
Yeah, that is just guessing. Now, in that article, Nate predicted that Trump would lose the nomination, and his evidence as to why was largely not based on hard data science, but on history. Quote, 12 years ago, in 2003, Joe Lieberman led in most polls of the Democratic primary. 8 years ago, on August 2007, Rudy Giuliani maintained a clear lead in polls of Republicans, while Hillary Clinton led polls of the Democratic nomination contest. 4 years ago, in August 2011, when Mitt Romney began with a lead in the polls of Republican voters, but he would be surpassed by the end of the month by Rick Perry, the first of four Republican rivals who would at some point overtake Romney in the national polling averages. Lieberman, Clinton, Giuliani, Perry, as you've probably gathered, are not the faces atop Mount Rushmore. Only Clinton came close to winning the nomination.
Ugh.
Following that, Silver included one of his own Twitter posts in the article, which makes him look pretty dumb in retrospect. So this is a tweet from August 9th, 2015 by Nate Silver. And he's like, he's doing it as like a little script. "Media, Trump's doing great. Nerds, no, those polls don't mean what you think. Media, a new poll shows Trump doing great. Proved you wrong." Yeah, he's okay.
So how can you be like that, not self-aware? Like, that's just parody. Also, it's interesting that he's done this sort of, like, if you look at history, actually, the polls change. And that he doesn't do that for Joe Biden, does he?
No, we don't. No, he does not.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Interesting. It's September, and he's has not made that point.
Learned his lesson.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, the problem with Nate Silver is pretty obvious. He's never gotten out of the habit of treating political predictions like sports. In baseball, appealing to history makes sense because there are thousands upon thousands of games and thousands upon thousands of players, and you have a lot of data with which you can use to draw useful conclusions. American politics does not work that way. There are, comparatively speaking, relatively few congresspeople and elections in recorded history, and even fewer presidents. Outliers, then, matter a lot more, and making accurate predictions based on history is much harder. But even in that article, Nate fell directly back on his baseball history to help justify his opinion that Trump had no chance. Quote, so should you ignore those national polls entirely? In a literal sense, they do have some correlation with election outcomes. Even this far out, a candidate near the top of the polls is a somewhat better bet to win the nomination than one near the bottom. But that's like projecting a major league pitcher's numbers from high school stats. Sure, you'd rather draft a random 17-year-old with a 2.14 ERA than another one with a 3.31 ERA if that's all the information you have to go by. But that data doesn't reveal very much, and its predictive power tends to be swamped by other indicators.
This is so wild. Like,
yeah, it's really dumb.
Like,
yeah.
An actual, like, you can look at a player's, like, actual performance over their entire career and, like, judge them based off of that. How do you bring that logic to politics and elections?
Yeah, it worked for a while. You got to give him that.
It worked for a while, but, like, even the logic of it isn't, like,
right.
Sound.
Yeah.
It worked, but some of it's luck.
Yes, a lot of it is luck. And in that article, Nate made it, it stated that our emphatic prediction is simply that Trump will not win the nomination. It's not even clear right. that he's trying to do so.
Well, that might be true. I don't know that Trump was trying to actually win.
That is a fair point. Now, I'm obviously far from the first person to criticize Nate for treating politics like the baseballs. Among the community of people who understand statistics, he has quite a few detractors. One of them is Nassim Taleb. Nassim is one of a galaxy of thinkers who got famous thanks to Malcolm Gladwell. He's an investor with a unique philosophy on risk that I don't really understand, and a very successful history of making money via predicting bad economic shit and then capitalizing on it.
I understand
Nassim that. Nassim Taleb does not like Nate. Nate does not like Nassim. And starting in 2015 or so, the two started shitfighting on Twitter. Their disagreements are fairly nerdy, and I am not competent to get into the weeds of their deeper statistical slap fights or to say who's right. What's important is that you know that this was not a friendly rivalry, and Nassim took to commenting on Silver's methods on Twitter. He regularly chimed in on comments made by other individuals criticizing 538. And then, in April of 2018, this happened. So a guy named Joachim Marnitz, like he posts like a criticism of 538's Nowcast. Mm-hmm. Nassim Taleb comments to that, yes, the Nowcast came out later and is BS. And Nate Silver weighs in, Nassim, it's pathetic that for the last 2 years you favorited, retweeted hundreds of comments from random Twitter nobodies that take your side of the argument. Maybe you should save some of your dignity and debate me. To which Nassim responds, Silver, you're a quack. Do not engage me. Just broadcast to your followers. 3 million or 3 billion doesn't make a difference. I write formal papers. To which Nate responds, LOL, I can't believe all it took was for someone to stand up to your bullying by trolling you back to turn you into such a cuck.
Oof.
Calls him a cuck.
Oh. Nate's liver.
Yeah.
Oh.
Classy. I love it.
Oh, unironically calling someone a cuck like that.
And
oh
like, Nassim also, comes out as a bit of a dick in that, too. Like, they both seem like unpleasant
yeah. oh,
people
absolutely.
I wouldn't want to have dinner with.
They're having a moment online. I highly doubt that Nate actually laughed out loud.
I love that his response, like, Nassim comes out with the incredibly arrogant, like, in any other argument, somebody, like, trying to argue that they're right by saying, I write formal papers, would be the person I sympathize with least in that argument.
Yeah.
Nate follows up by calling him a cuck.
Yeah, LOL, you're a cuck. And end of argument.
Oh, it's amazing.
No one looks good here.
Yeah, it's incredible. So in December of that year, Isaac Farber wrote a really interesting breakdown of the spat between Nassim and Nate on the Medium blog Towards Data Science. It is a very wonky dissection of 538, and I will not pretend to understand every piece of the math that this guy brings up in it. Faber does not call 538 useless, and certainly seems to see value in Nate's analysis of the polls. But he also criticizes Silver for accepting praise for his not-a-prediction predictions of the 2008 election results. Quote, he should not have accepted the honor if he didn't call a winner in any of the states, which is a fair point.
If you didn't predict anything, don't take credit for predicting it. Yeah.
Faber points out that there are two types of uncertainty in any prediction, aleatory and epistemic. If aleatory uncertainty is the probability of, say, rolling a six on a standard die, epistemic would have more to do with the uncertainty involved in getting certain results in a specific game or with specific other types of dice or whatever. Like, it has to do with more with the system. I'm going to quote from his write-up now. Quote, bespoke models like 538's only report to the public aleatory uncertainty as it concerns their statistical outputs. The trouble is that epistemic uncertainty is very difficult, sometimes impossible to estimate. For example, why didn't 538's model incorporate, before it happened, a chance that Comey would reopen his investigation into the Clinton emails? Sports, like other games of chance, have very well-defined mechanisms which lend themselves to statistical analysis. On the other hand, highly nonlinear events like contested elections may not. With fewer data points, you can see the variation of the Senate predictions is enormous. Gauging the performance of models on these types of events becomes doubly difficult. It isn't clear if a prediction is wrong owing to the quality of the model, epistemic, or just luck, aleatory. Because there is so much uncertainty around nonlinear events, like an election, it could reasonably be considered frivolous to report early-stage forecasts. The only conceivable reason to do so is to capture and monetize the interest of a public which is hungry to know the future. I will not go into the technical arguments. Taleb has written and published a paper on the key issues with a solution. Here we can say, with some confidence, that 538 predictions are not always reliable probabilities.
Seems fair.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Solid math slapdown on Nate there. Yeah. Now, if the last several months are anything to judge by, Nate Silver still suffers from the problem of weighing his own biases too heavily in his predictions, even when the numbers don't back him up. Back in August 2019, Nate tweeted about an analysis of campaign finance data published by the Washington Post. This analysis looked at the people who had donated to Democratic presidential campaigns and concluded that Sanders had the most loyal base of any campaign because more than 80% of his donors gave just to him. Here's how Nate interpreted that data on Twitter. So basically, Bernie fans only like Bernie, and only Bernie fans like Bernie. Now, a number of people pointed out that this was not a fair analysis. I found a good website on the very biased Splinter News website that nonetheless hits at some of Nate's core issues. Quote, first of all, it should not be surprising whatsoever that 99% of people who have donated to Sanders' anti-establishment campaign did not then turn around and give money to former Vice President Joe Biden. Sanders' base is loyal, and there are a few other candidates who truly share his goals like Medicare for All. Plus, many of his donors have given in small amounts, so it makes sense to think that they may not have money to give elsewhere.
Sure.
But the chart and the story clearly show, despite Silver's suggestion, that roughly 20% of Sanders supporters gave to other campaigns. Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren share 60,000 donors. Sanders supporters also gave to Rep. Tulsi Gabbard in significant amounts. Most overlapping donors gave more money to Sanders. Now, a number of people also pointed out that, while Sanders donors tended to be loyal, a number of donors to other Democratic candidates also donated to Sanders, which would suggest that supporters of other candidates don't hate Bernie even if they do prefer Kamala Harris or Mayor Pete. More to the point is the fact that since Sanders has so many small-dollar donors who only gave to him, this suggests something else very important that Nate missed entirely. Malaika Jabali, who writes for The Guardian, The Intercept, and The Root, pointed this out in a tweet. Quote, today we learn that Sanders gets support from people who may not normally be drawn to Democratic candidates. Something tells me that might come in handy in November.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's all pretty clear evidence that Nate, like everyone, lets his personal opinions cloud his analysis, even when he claims to just be looking at the numbers. Data can be interpreted in numerous ways, and it's clear to me that Silver has an anti-Bernie bias. His actual articles on 538 are fairer about Sanders. In July, he published an article about how Bernie was, quote, ahead of the pack on healthcare. And in February, one of his editors, Claire Malone, wrote an article about how Bernie could win the 2020 nomination. But even in his supposedly unbiased coverage, Nate has a tendency to reveal himself, as best embodied by this June 6th, 2019 headline. Bernie Sanders has the highest floor, and it's pretty damn low.
Okay.
Where he's like pointing out that Sanders has like the highest like floor of support of any of the Democratic candidates, but it's low, so it's not a big, like,
yeah.
Come on, dude. Like, yeah.
Oh, he does that all the time.
Yeah.
Sorry, we were supposed to write brief summaries of these people, and I wrote 9 pages, and
no,
I apologize.
But you got through that so fast.
Yeah,
it was hard to. I was biting my tongue so much because I knew we had limited time. I didn't want to interject. Yeah. It was interesting.
Yeah, that covers a lot of my already held opinions about Nate Silver.
Yeah.
I mean, we could go through every one of his tweets and be like, well, here's how you're misrepresenting it.
Let's not, though.
We're not going to. I will not be reading all of my responses to Nate Silver's tweets.
He's got some zingers in there.
Got some zingers. Hey, folks, there's some good tweets in there. All right. But oof, boy, he. Yeah, just take him with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take everybody with a grain
of salt. Take everybody with a grain of salt.
Take everybody with a grain of salt. But again, particularly people who claim to have some sort of like, that their analysis is based purely on the numbers.
Yeah.
Because there's always more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
right.
and again, predictions, like one of the most valuable things I think about that, the quote that I read from that like statistical wonk Medium blog was the point that you, when you're analyzing sports, there are rules to baseball. You know that a game of baseball is not going to be impacted by one of the players pulling out a gun and shooting the ball out of the air, mm-hmm. because then that guy would be ejected and that would not be part of the game because it's not part of the rules of baseball. You can't shoot a ball out of the air with a gun. You can't do the same thing with politics because all sorts of shit happens and there really aren't rules. And so at any moment, the FBI director can reopen an investigation into a candidate's emails. Or a candidate could pull his dick out, or right. like anything
or
can happen.
Access Hollywood tape.
There are
like,
variables you yeah. cannot account for.
The idea that like you can treat politics the way you treat sports is fundamentally asinine.
Yeah.
Also dangerous, I think.
And dangerous.
Right. It sort of like reinforces this sort of like the racehorse sort of narrative of yeah. like how politics go. But also like, I mean, yeah. baseball like. You can observe somebody's actual skill level and what they accomplish, and like yeah. translating that to what people think of a candidate. Mm-hmm. That's not how yeah. it is.
It's yeah. completely different. Yeah.
And there would be like if Donald Trump was the 1,000th president, Nate would have more of a leg to stand on because then there would be enough numbers that like it would kind of boil out some of like the weird fringe chances of things happening just because right. there would be so much data. But there's not.
You haven't even had 50.
Yeah.
I don't think he would
that's
support
crazy to think
studies
about.
With that sample size. yeah. Yeah, that is crazy.
You're like, wow, oof, we've got a ways to go before we hit 1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we go, I wanted to give Washington Post its due.
Oh.
Yeah.
In regards to Bernie Sanders coverage,
mm-hmm.
And share with you this headline from 2015, and I want you both to guess who you think wrote it.
Okay.
20,000 people came to see Bernie Sanders in Boston. Why aren't we talking more about it? Fair question. Who wrote it?
Oh God, I don't know.
Chris Cillizza.
Really?
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah. I didn't even know he wrote for the Washington Post.
I didn't either.
Unbelievable. Good take, Chris. Your one good take. Yeah.
Well, this has been great.
Yeah, we know what to read and listen to and what
yeah,
not
you guys
to read
feel,
and not
you guys feel
to.
Clear on where to get your information?
Yes. Breitbart, right?
.com? Yes.
Breitbart.
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. where we landed. Mm-hmm. Good.
V-Dare's good one.
Oh, V-Dare's great. Mm-hmm. The Daily Stormer, some
Ooh,
really hot
sure.
takes.
Mm. Daily Caller. Yeah.
Mm, Daily,
Daily
Caller.
Caller.
Yep.
For sure.
Gateway Pundit.
Yeah.
Daily Mail. All the dailies.
Daily Mail.
All the dailies.
You know what
Daily
I love
Wire.
About the Daily Mail is when the Daily Mail reposted the entirety of a mass shooter's manifesto.
Just uncritically just like
shooters.
Plastered it on yeah. the... I didn't know they did that. What the heck?
Yeah, they did that because they're responsible journalists, Cody.
Oh, that's wow. why.
That's what that looks like.
That's why. Okay.
Yes. So stay tuned for the next episode of this podcast, wherein I read Anders Breivik's manifesto with no commentary.
You mean you're going to read 12 Rules for Life?
God.
Not to say that they're the same, but I feel like. Maybe Jordan Peterson read a little Anders and was like, yeah, he's kind of right about a lot of stuff.
Yeah. He had that decision we all have where you have to choose between being a rich political personality who gets paid to lecture at colleges and shooting dozens of children. And thankfully, he chose the
He chose
other
the right one. He chose yeah. the right one.
It's working yeah. out for him.
Yeah. I feel like the root of the problem is still there. But
yeah, yeah.
How
yeah.
the tree grew is a better.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, better tree.
So stay tuned for more of the worst year ever. Yeah. Also, stay tuned for the literal worst year ever.
And for the literal, yeah.
Yeah, the actual year and the show about the year. We'll be ratcheting this up
yeah.
more later.
Yeah, not every episode is going to be us talking about media sources. No. It's going to be talking about a lot of other stuff. But I feel good about this. I think this is a great place for us to start.
Yeah, it's a good primer.
Trust,
get some perspective. And...
Trust only us.
That's what we mean.
That's the takeaway this two-parter is to give you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trust only us, and you know, that way you'll just kind of uncritically accept it when we start pushing our secret dark horse candidate yep. for 2020.
Absolutely.
Theodore Kaczynski.
I thought you were going to go with Vermin Supreme, but you went with Kaczynski. Okay.
Real quick before you go, make sure to check out our website. It's www.worstyearpod.com. And on both Instagram and Twitter, we're at Worst Year Pod. Simple.
Heck yeah.
Ease to remember. We all just followed it. I said ease because it was easier than saying easy.
It's way easier than saying easy.
I'm really good at ending podcasts.
So like and subscribe. And in the meantime, maybe stockpile some dried food. Maybe buy a machete and some bolt cutters. Maybe pick up, you know, a couple of months of extra your prescription, whatever that happens to be. Maybe hoard insulin. Maybe buy ammo. Whatever.
Sounds good.
Order all of that from Amazon.com.
Choose one day delivery to put lots of people's lives in risk, right? Isn't that a thing?
And stay tuned for our next episode on why Medicare for All just isn't very practical.
Hard agree. I think good things are impossible.
We have a new tagline.
Good things are impossible. Enjoy the worst year ever.
What was the one failing?
Just like
From the last episode, failing something.
Failing spectacularly, something like that.
Failing spectacularly, yes. Well, guys, we did it.
Cool. Bye.
You know what? Bye.
Bye.
Everything's so dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.